workshop has been a pretty much a continuous one, with some things tied together all week long. And I want to do a little bit of weekend review, like Holden Village does when you get to have all the... That's my favorite meal. I really do like all the little pieces and bits. At any rate, I'm a marriage, child, and family practice person. We have a practice in Bellevue. And one part of our practice is to work with sexual misconduct issues. And sexual misconduct is the term that I'm using, but because I really want to push that term. And the way I'm using that term is any kind of sexual boundary crossing that happens in any situation where there's more power versus less power. Now, in our program, we work basically with two different groups. We work with actually, I've got some of them up here. We work with people who are involved in addictions or in obsessive compulsive disorders, or we also work with people, child molesters and so forth, and that gets called child abuse or child molestation. But my press here is to use it as sexual misconduct to keep it more in a generic kind of sense that any crossing of any sexual boundaries. And I've been talking about that in various ways all week long. I showed this overhead yesterday, but just as a reminder, I want to refer to this one again today for just a minute. The reason I want to do that is as we talk today about what are the things that we can do about it, about this issue, I want to make sure that we have, again, a sense of the numbers of people that we're talking about. And so, by clinical definitions, which I'm not taking the time to go into right now, folks that are have been defined as needing to be in treatment for alcohol and basically alcohol abuse, we're talking about 36 million, roughly 15% of the population, and eating disorder, eating addictions, 10.4, other drug addictions, 8.3, co-addicts, which I suspect that's way low, because we don't really have a good clinical definition of what the disease of co-addiction is. We are ravaged by it in our society, but we don't have a good definition of what it is. Workaholism, and sex and love addiction, 6%, and then some of the others. And the reason I wanted to refer to that, sex and love addictions, is because, well, for instance, Craig, you were mentioning to me last night, what was it, 16,000 ordained pastors in the Lutheran Church?
Yes.
Give or take a few. Well, everything I know, everything I read, my own personal work of 10, 15, 20 years, all tells me that the percentage would be roughly the same among ordained people also. So whatever 6% of 16,000 ELC pastors you're going to have, anybody quick at that? What kind of number would be?
1,000.
Okay, so what's that?
Well,
who can do that quick? I can't do that quick.
6%
of
what?
1,000.
Look at that. Somebody can do that quick. So we're talking about 1,000 pastors, for instance, who would be dealing with these kinds of issues. And just to get some kind of a framework that, you know, and then there's a selecting quality, and there's some people that would not be in that regular number because they would select out, because you'd say, well, pastors would go into that for different reasons, and then there'd be a whole number of pastors that go into the pastoral role to heal themselves, and so they would go into it because they have those kinds of problems and hope that if I become in something that's more Christian than anything else, that will heal me. So I think that probably balances out. So anyway, you're talking about a significant number of people. I've brought a bunch of books, and I'll refer to them. I threw them down here because we didn't have the big thing to put around in the other room. I want to refer to, that's all I'm going to do in a weekend review. I want to refer to three different categories here that we talk about all leading up in my mind to the what can we do kind of issue. It's not this simple because I'm really trying to condense some things, but one kind of general, generic way of viewing this problem is that if we put people into three categories, and it doesn't quite fit, but it does fairly well. If you look at a sociopathic personality or a psychopathic personality or character disordered personality or whatever word like that speaks the most to you, this person, again, an oversimplification, concise statement might be that they would have no or low empathy. The ability to step into someone else's shoes. And what we look at most strongly here is this person is characterized in their personality by a lack of any kind of functioning that says, my behavior has this effect on you. A lot of us get at least slowed down by the fact that if I do such and such, it's going to create this problem for you, and that may at least make me feel bad, or might even stop me from doing it. Might not, but it might get in the way somewhere. This person, when they get caught, cry the same tears, and boy, does this ever get difficult in terms of working with or treatment or in terms of diagnosis, trying to figure out their mind. But this person cries because they get caught. This person doesn't cry because of what happened. They cry because they got caught. Now they cry just as sincerely, and the pain is just as great. And so it's really difficult not to get fooled here because the pain is enormous. And I don't work, to my knowledge, with these folks. When we do our differential diagnosis in our programs, in our treatment programs, we work predominantly with strata 2 and 3 here. Not that there aren't some people that work with these folks, but when we're working more in the obsessive compulsive areas and we're working more in the addictive areas, as we define them, our chances of making some inroads and really making changes and breaking the patterns are much greater here than they are here. So if you want to triage and you want to increase your chances of impacting somebody in a positive way and having your program have more success and build in a positive kind of way, you balance it with this. Now, I'm not saying that we don't have sociopathic personalities in our program. I'm saying we try not to. And I'm using extremes when I'm talking about here. This would clearly be Ted Bundy. This would be, folks of that ilk that I certainly don't know how to work with them in any kind of productive way. I don't know anybody that does. What you hope in the clinical field, as far as I know, the people that I talk, and I work a fair amount with prisons as well as outpatient settings, and in the state of Washington now, the inpatient sexual deviancy programs are all in a prison now. That's a shift. That's a fairly recent shift. But in that shift, those folks will tell you too that what they really basically hope is that the crime that this person commits keeps them in as long as they can keep them in. Because you really got two choices. You have to make a decision morally whether you believe in the death penalty or not. And if you choose not to believe in the death penalty, then you just hope that the sentence they get is long enough to keep them from going out and doing it again, whatever it is, because you know they will. We don't know today much what to do to stop this person. That's just kind of a bleak thing. Then you get into the legal issues that say, and I don't, there's one part of me that doesn't disagree with this, that you can only keep a person in jail for as long as what they did. You can't put them in jail for knowing what kind of person they are, so you ought to stay in there for the rest of your life. Can't do that. So they do something dastardly, and they get 7 years in jail, and 7 years is up, they go out, and the people that are working with them that I know are just saying, oh my gosh, I hope they're not out there too long before they get back in, because you know they're pretty much going to do it again, because we don't know really how to stop that. Okay, so much for bleak. I think we know how to do some things with these other folks. The obsessive compulsive disorder, and the addiction, I put down, again, I'm really being as concise as I can, and if you could certainly challenge me on oversimplifying, because I'm really oversimplifying. It's a dysfunctional way to reduce anxiety. When it's very extreme, and you see these folks in a mental hospital, you'll see folks get caught up in numbers, you'll see folks not being able to walk across a line, because they'll come up to a line and they'll back and they'll begin to perseverate and they'll stop, or they'll be hand washers or something. And all of those kinds of behaviors, that's real extreme out on a continuum. All those kinds of behaviors are behaviors that are, they're attempts for this person to control their environment around them. And they become so anxious that they have to go to a very simplistic, repetitive act to gain some kind of control, because inside they're just going absolutely crazy, and they go to this. Well, if you take that back, not as extreme, not nearly as extreme, but some kind of repetitive act that lowers tension, what some of them learn is some kind of sexually dysfunctional behavior. For instance, any kind of power abusive sexual behavior. Now, there may be a number of different dysfunctional ways to reduce anxiety. It may be that what they go to is drinking, or it may be they go to overeating, or it may be they go to, and you fill in the blank. Do you follow me? Those are all dysfunctional ways to reduce anxiety. One of the things that's real important, if you're talking about an obsessive compulsive diagnosis, at least where we are today, probably you're going to want to do some kind of medication with this person, and it's enormously helpful. If you really do it carefully and do it well, might be lithium or Prozac or some of the good psychotropic medications that really can help this person so that they're not, don't get so anxious that they can only turn to, let's say, excessive repetitive masturbation or something which gets them very anxious, and then it calms them. That's all I'm going to say about that. The third one is the addiction model, and that's what I'm talking more about than anything else, and next week we'll talk only about. And looking at the addiction model, these two books, this one isn't for sale here, I recommended they buy this one. Pat Carnes actually wrote both of these, and I suggested here at the bookstore that they have this one. It's an excellent book. These are both excellent books, and they talk about this thing called sexual addiction and what it is, and give you some pretty good background. So I recommend that the people look at it, and I think this is a little bit... This one has many more anecdotes, and I think this one's a little more... theoretical. They're both very readable books. And again, an oversimplification is that the addiction is to numb pain. There is some pain, there is some distress, there is some dysfunction that's happened that, and again, you can, in any kind of addiction, if you want to numb out, you can numb out with lust, you can numb out with food, you can numb out with cocaine, you can numb out with whatever you want to numb out with. We learned a long time ago, working with people that abuse drugs, that one of the kind of street pseudonyms for a drug abuser is a head. And the reason, kind of interestingly enough, that you call somebody who's a drug abuser a head is because they're basically in their head. They're not into their feelings. And the reason they're not into their feelings is that the feelings are too painful to deal with. There is some thing or series of things that have gone on that are too painful to deal with. Now, not that anybody's particularly aware of that. It isn't like you consciously think, oh, I'm going to stick some nose candy up my nose because I'm too much in pain in my life to deal with that. And you don't consciously think that. But when you get heavy into treatment, that's one of the most difficult things to do, is when somebody comes out of toxicity and begins to get some recovery, life gets much worse before it gets better, because you have a whole lot of feelings to deal with, and this has kept you from dealing with that. But the whole addiction kind of thing, what we find is that most of the people that we work with have often a combination of both of these. We have our largest number of people we work with will be strictly in the addictive model, fair number of them will be here, and as I said, if we can tease them out, we don't work with these folks at all. All three of these, and I did this intentionally, all above may appear to be, and that's why I pointed to this group, because these people don't look any different. They're us folks, you know, they're not any different, they don't walk or talk any different, and they don't work any different, except I would say, by and large, if I were to pick a characteristic or two, I'd say they're a little more successful in generally in life, because all three have at least some of the narcissistic need to overcompensate. So they're probably some of your better teachers, or some of your better ministers, or some of your better football coaches, or some of your better counselors, you know, because they've had to scramble hard because there's this drivenness inside. But they're may actually be bright or caring, intelligent, highly capable Christian people, and I put in Christian people on purpose because I really want you to clearly understand that there's a whole lot of Christian folks that are caught up in these issues and these pains very much. Now, I pointed this one may appear to be because I don't believe this person is caring or sensitive or empathic. I do believe this person is caring or sensitive or empathic. You follow the difference there? Whatever happens for this person, it happens because they want it to happen, and it ultimately comes down to doing what they want, although they may appear to look like it's something different. I was trying to think of some examples, and I was in the library yesterday looking at some, and I found an old book that may be here, but I hadn't read it in too long, Elmer Gantry, who was a long time before a lot of the pastors that have created great, you know, all the newspapers and the headlines. Most of the recent ones, if I could diagnose from the outside, Swigert and Baker and those fellows, I would really say are more in the addiction side, be my guess. It could well be that Elmer Gantry, as he was portrayed in the book, I would guess maybe more on the sociopathic side, but that's hard to say. How can you say from the outside? But that would be my guess. And so this one appears that way, but I want to get the idea across that this person, when challenged, when confronted, when having to deal with the issue, often is highly shamed. Now, in that shame, may move into an incredibly strong denial pattern because, and here's again where we differentiate between the two, this one moves into the denial pattern because he thinks he can get away with it. This one moves into these two move into the denial pattern because it's so painful to admit that I did these bad things. I mean, it really rips their guts out. Now, it doesn't rip their guts out enough to stop them from doing it. Don't ever think that. But it does create intense agony and pain. And this creates the problem. Now, like yesterday, as we were talking about what do you do for victims, and you get sensitized to victims, and when you are working with victims and have seen people be victimized and seen the pain that people go through and all that, it's like, who's got any room for the offender short of a shotgun? I mean, you know, it's easy to be just so enraged at when you see the victim. One of the ways that we try to handle that at our office is, and I say this, it's fairly atypical, but every one of us works both with offenders and victims, not in the same family, but we all work with victims and we all work with offenders. And I think that gives us a better balance, because I may go in and work with a group of child molesters, and that day I may have seen two children who had been molested. And it does one of two things for you. Either get a balance or you go crazy. Now, several people that I know, one counseling group that I know, will only work with victims. And even in terms of the kind of metaphysical thing, they won't even let a victim, an offender, be in the building ever walk through the door. Of course, I don't know how, since there's a certain percentage of offenders in the society anyway. I don't know how they'd ever know. Do you know what I mean? But still, they make that stated position, and I really respect that position. I don't want to do it that way. I think we do better if we work with all three. But again, to use your figures, I would have to believe that there are as many in the churches and in all churches for the same reasons as there are among computer engineers and as there are among brick masons and, you know, whatever. Because the things that lead us to handle our dysfunction and our ways of interacting with the world are neither heterosexual nor homosexual, and they're neither so it's not a male and female issue. And basically, I'll keep preaching this, it's not really a genital issue. It's much more between the ears than it is between the legs. It's an incredible attempt and cry for intimacy, and handled in a very dysfunctional way. But that's what it's all about. I make statements like that, you know, and that sounds loving and warm and humanistic and Christian. And somebody asked me one time, and a friend of mine said, "Don't say that in public." He said, "What would you do if someone raped or molested one of your daughters?" And I said, "I'd probably kill him." And I don't even believe in capital punishment. But what I'm trying to say is, what I believe and what I might do as a human being in grief or in pain or in my own dysfunction may be two different things. I'd like to be loving and accepting and figure that that person is treatable and a human being and who was dysfunctionally operational. But I don't know if I could do that if it came that close to home. So I don't try to pretend that I could do that if it came that close to home. I hope I could. I wish I could, but I don't know. I don't ever want to find out. I just hope I never have to deal with that. What do we do? I put down some things, and then I just want to open it up and get some reactions and see. These are strong beliefs of mine if we set up a what do we do kind of situation. We have to have a program of prevention, and I put an A, B, and I know you're supposed to put B under A, and I goofed. I believe that in a program of prevention, one of the things we have to do in the churches is break the patriarchal pattern. I just don't see how that can stay where it is. By the patriarchal pattern, what I mean is many of us want to put the pastor in a role of patriarch and father and God and all other kinds of things that we want to do to that person, or mother and God, but whatever, you know, we do that to that person. And many pastors, as well as doctors, as well as therapists, as well as attorneys that I know, foster that. Well, in this kind of role, I think that's very, very dangerous, because for the most of them, if there's 6% that cross the line, that means there's 94% that don't. And for the 94% that don't, that's fine. But for the 6% that do, or 10% or 3% or whatever it is, that patriarchal role is so powerful that you don't have any access to talk to anybody. You know, in some churches, there's not a bishop to go talk to. There's not a committee that you can speak to. There's not a personnel committee that you can go to and say, "My pastor," as I've had four people already tell me this week, that my pastor tried to rape me, and in one case succeeded. You know, what do you do with that? You go to the personnel committee and you say, "My pastor came to my house and attempted to rape me." You think they're going to believe you? I mean, unless there is a preventative kind of system set up where you know and the pastor knows and it's on the committee and the personnel committee has talked about it, and you've said, and every one of you's gone on back to your church and you've said, "You know, what would happen in our church, and how powerful is our pastor, and how tight is he with the bishop, and is there some kind of check and balance in case he was that way?" Take it into the family when we look at the patriarchal thing. Let me first say that I wish that I didn't live in a society that was like this. But I do live in a society that's like this. And so I think we have to say, and they'll say it, if you don't know this, at least in the state of Washington, they will say this real clearly, somewhere in the first, second, or third grade to your children, that if anybody touches you in funny places, you go tell. Even daddy. You go tell. So they're beginning to build a system so that even if daddy touches you in a wrong place, there's someone to tell. And they build this in. Like I say, I wish I didn't live in a world where that was the case, but there are daddies that do that, and there are ministers that do that. In the schools, and somewhat in the families, we're beginning to build that preventative kind of system in. But in the churches, we often haven't done that. Particularly a non-denominational church that doesn't have a bishop to go talk to. Who do you talk to when that's the main boss? That's kind of scary. So I really believe when we talk about what do? We have to have something to break what I'm calling the patriarchal system, and something, some system to address abuse. What in your church, I don't know that you have to answer me, but if you can't answer me, it'd be nice if you'd find out. In your church, what do you do if someone on staff abuses someone else? Is there a set plan? Is there someone that the person can talk to? Is your pastor so defensive that he would say, I don't want us to do anything like that because that encourages it, or that makes it happen, or things like that? That's pretty scary to me, because that keeps too much power in that role. Second thing is a victim response program, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing again, but we spent quite a bit of time in yesterday's meeting talking about the victim response role, and I really believe that Marie Fortune, in her book and in her workshops and in the workshops we do when a church calls us up, after this is in place, usually, hopefully after this is in place, because you're really at a disadvantage and people get hurt a lot more if you don't get called until someone has been abused. But she talks in here, sets her in her chapter on doing justice and mercy, and she talks about her points of truth-telling, acknowledging the violation, compassion, protecting the vulnerable, accountability, restitution, and vindication. Not vengeance, but vindication. Setting up that kind of system so that if someone, and I strongly recommend that book. I would like to see every church have a system that incorporates these points. I don't care if you have Marie Fortune come in, but you know, I think that the things, I think they're very biblical. I think they're solid. I think if they're carried through, and particularly if you've set them in place before something happens, I think it can be done in such a way so there's restoration. And I really believe that it's impossible for the victim to become a survivor, because that's the term that we like to use, that you go from a position of vulnerability to a position of victimization to a position of a survivor. It's impossible for that to happen if the truth isn't told, if secrets aren't broken, if you don't have an acknowledgement by the offender, and if there isn't some kind of vindication, maybe they pay for the victim's therapy, something. And I really don't believe that the offender has a chance to work it through without all those steps. Now, I think our first emphasis has to be for the victims, but I think for the offender also. What about the offender, and I don't want to major too much in this, who's caught in this kind of pattern, who, among other things, besides having transgressed, happens to be a caring, capable Christian person who is also the best youth pastor you've ever seen, and who really wants to spend the next 20 years doing that kind of work? Without all those steps I just mentioned, which really make it a healthy place for the victim, there can be no restoration for that person. They may go sell cars, or they may go get a different church, because my experience in both public schools and churches is generally, and that's the horror story that she talks about in this book, where she uses a true example but fictionalizes it, is that the pastor basically is quietly fired and moves off and gets a job with another church. And more than likely continues the same pattern. And that happens a lot. Sometimes it doesn't. I had a pastor call me from a neighboring city about 2 years ago. This is one of those rare things that happens, you know. He called me from a neighboring city and said, in a moment of just pure anguish over the telephone, I didn't know him. He thought I knew him. He thought I'd met him at a conference, and actually it was a wrong conference, and I'd never met him. But he just poured out his soul about his addiction to pornographic arcades and so forth, and dancers and going in, and his time, he was increasing and increasing, and at one time he'd only gone when he was out of town on pastoral conferences, but now he was doing it more and more in his own town, and had been caught twice by his own parishioners, and then his wife found out, and anyway, he said, told him some things to do and some treatment to get in and so forth, and he said, okay, make an appointment. He didn't make the appointment, didn't follow the appointment, called me 2.5 years later and said, I read the books that you wanted me to read. This was one of them. He said, I read that book. My wife and I decided, one, that we were going to stay together, two, that we were going to leave that church. I went to a neighboring state, got into treatment for 2 years, and you know, and that was just great to hear that. And he said, I think I can work back into working in churches with certain safeguards that I will set up, and there are some things that he can do. He decided to do that on his own. There was no set system to either encourage that or force that. Short of that, with the addiction being as powerful as it is, that isn't going to happen, folks. I know of a dormancy period with, I don't know the fellow, the pastor at the church that I was at talked one day about a good friend of his who was a cocaine addict who was dormant for 14 years and then went on a 6-month binge. And now is back restored and working in a church again. But you know, that can just grab you as soon as you start thinking that the power of the addiction isn't there. And we're talking about the same kind of addiction. The third thing is some kind of program for the offenders, accountability and treatment. And accountability comes out of one of these steps where, it's never quite this simple, but I talk with all the folks of, one of the things you absolutely have to do if you're going to get into any kind of recovery program as an offender here, one is that you have to accept yourself as an offender and get out of denial. And you absolutely have to have a group in which you break secrets, in which there are no secrets. Everything is laid out, every graphic detail. And I believe that this group has to be more than one. I believe that this group has to be non-codependent on the offender, not somebody that the offender can control. It has to be 2, 3, 4 people. It has to be forever. And if that group isn't around, you find somebody else. And that's your sharing group. And you break secrets constantly, and you tell them everything. Everything. And they've got to be willing to walk that road with you, because I really believe that's part of restoration. I believe that there's a second level in which you tell some things. This might be your partner, in which you don't tell everything. I think it's crucial that you tell everything to somebody, but to your church council or to your partner, I don't think you need to say that we had intercourse at such and such a motel on Thursday night at 2:00 in the morning, and these are the sexual activities that we did. You know, those. You don't need that kind of stuff, particularly. But I do think that needs to happen here. But at this level, there's a group of people, also a select group, that you tell basically what's going on, and you break denial, and you're honest. But you don't tell everything when you don't go in that kind of detail. And I think there's a third group of people, and please don't misunderstand me, that I'm not talking about being secretive, but you don't tell anything to. And as long as these two groups are in place, I don't think you have to tell everything to the world. I've had numerous people who, in the compulsive confessor phase, it feels so good to break the secrets and start getting out from under that junk that you've been carrying, that want to go in and want to tell it in front of church on Sunday night and get 2,000 people there and tell everything. For one thing, that's very self-centered, because most of the people who come to their church on Sunday, they don't want to hear all that. Another thing is that many of them will crucify you. I mean, they will absolutely crucify you. And I'm not really interested in setting up a martyr so that we can get you crucified, so that then you can feel, oh, you know, woe is me, and they're being so nasty to me, and it proves that I'm really, you know, it gets all sick and crazy. So I think there's a group of people here that, unless it becomes appropriate, you don't talk about this stuff. You don't need to do that to the world, as long as step one and step two are happening. Does that make some sense? But step one and step two have to be happening. We tell everybody that gets in treatment, this is for the rest of your life. This is like diabetes. You get a core group. And if some people burn out on you, then you find another one or two. And the criteria for me is it's always more than one, because any of us can manipulate one person, you know? And we can tell them how sad we are, how unhappy we are, how painful we are, what poopy stuff happened to us all our life, or mama wasn't nice to us or something. And we can convince anybody, any one person. So you get two or three, and they've got to be people that you don't have in your hip pocket, but who care enough about you to work with this thing. And maybe more than care about you, maybe they care more about the congregation. You know, but maybe they're willing to go that route with you. Now, those are the things that I think you have to have. Shut up time and say, you know, what do we do? What do you think? Do you want to add to that? Do you want to disagree with some of what I've laid out there? Do you want to go to sleep? It's Saturday afternoon and it's hot, and who am I kidding? Yeah.
Clarification, if you have a pastor in category one, there's probably not too much hope to continue.
Yeah, I can't. Diagnosing category one is always tough. Once you're in that category, I don't think you got much chance to, again, I'm being harsh here, but here we counsel, here we control. Here you just make the guy as unempowered as possible and try to make it where he can do as little damage as possible.
Or move him on, as it seems happens.
Yeah, and that's a shame.
Yeah,
but
move a problem to another.
And what happens here is you read the letters of reference and nothing gets mentioned, because you're hoping, oh, please God, take him, and I can't say anything bad, because if I say anything bad, nobody else will take him, and we want to get him out of here because we're real codependent and we don't want to cause pain for him, but we do want to get rid of him because we don't want him to hurt anybody else in our place. It's a real chicken way to go. Happens all the time. And I would say we got to do all this by committee. This is going to sound funny that I would jump to here, but when you're deciding who do you tell everything to, who do you tell some things to, who do you tell nothing to, I don't believe the offender can make that judgment, because your thinking isn't clear. Okay? So you use your group to help you decide who do you talk to. Same as here, no one person decides. You get some professionals involved. I would say you get an interventionist. And there are interventionists now in every city of any size, and if not, somebody will fly in who's got experience with this. And do you know what I mean by intervention? Okay, so you do an intervention just like you do an alcohol intervention. But before you do an intervention, you get two or three people around, and you get a couple of professionals involved who understand how to make that kind of thing. And then you draw the thing together, and you go in and you say, you got two choices, you know, and one of them's getting treatment or whatever, you know, that's the kind of thing. But this is tough. And I think we all know, most of you are nodding yes, that there's a fair number of folks, by dint of intelligence and ability and power, that grow into very successful positions who are really pretty scary.
You have to be pretty brilliant to get through some of those things. I mean, to not get through them, but to have a problem and still be successful. I think it takes a lot of brilliance.
Yeah, I'm not sure you do, because you got to have a lot of effort. But see, most of us so strongly want to put the power person up there and want to believe that they're okay, and want to believe that they're all that they pretend to be, that we look the other way, time after time after time. I've got a book I didn't bring down here by the fellow that started the Betty Ford Clinic, and his was alcohol. It wasn't. He's a physician. His was alcohol and not sex addiction, but his coworkers and family tried so hard not to recognize his alcohol addiction, and he lists in his book five times when he was hospitalized with direct alcohol and problems where he was in doing some surgery, and he was so drunk he kept falling down and different kinds of things. Five times he was hospitalized himself, and nobody ever would put down that he was alcoholic. They wouldn't write it down on, you know, he was wrecking cars, he was doing all kinds of things. Finally, they all got together and he got in treatment and later started the Betty Ford Clinic, and then this speaks indirectly to an issue we're talking about here. His belief was, as rampant as alcohol and alcohol addiction and sex addiction and drug addiction and all the other addictions are in our society, he says, the real problem with me was that everybody else was codependent on me. And he says, I think our codependent stuff is much worse disease than alcohol or sex or something like that. Because nobody would say to me, you got to get treatment, and I'm going to throw you out on your ear if you don't.
Okay, so, for him to say that.
Yes. Here's a couple nice books. I've got all those other books too. Codependent No More, and I think you got to read them together. But this Ann Wilson Chafe's books, I think, are probably better. Codependent No More comes directly out of the alcohol experience. And if you want to read that book on codependency, you have to have an understanding, I think, that the concepts are the same, but basically it comes out of that model that says, for every alcoholic who's in a relationship, the person with whom they are in the relationship is codependent. Because one of two things has to happen for an alcoholic. Either they get confronted and quit drinking, or the person who supports them in their partner relationship becomes codependent and looks the other way. There isn't anything else left. They have to go along with it. So if they are in the relationship with the addict, then what is happening is the addict is addicted to the thing, and the codependent is addicted to the addict. And in that codependence, in their own pain, they just can't see some things. And so they can't act on some things. And that's not because they're not, I mean, they're all these things too. They're nice people, and they're gentle, loving, caring people who know something's wrong but don't dare do anything about that which is wrong. They can't do it because the risk is too great. Probably with both, the risk of abandonment is incredible, but maybe with the codependent, the risk of abandonment is even greater. And he'll put up with some. Anyway. Yes, sir?
What are some characteristics of a sociopath? What are some of the key...
Well, he's a legend in his own mind, for one thing. He or she, because I don't think there's any stronger male or female here. Everything that's done, or essentially everything that's done, is done the way 14-year-olds do them. I'm being more vague than I want to be. You know, when you're 14 years old and you're very self-centered, we just call it adolescence. And when you're 40 years old and you're still that self-centered, we call it narcissism. And that's more this kind of thing. We don't like it, but we expect your 14-year-old to have a tantrum because you can't take her to the movie when you just found out that your sister's got cancer. And she says, okay, I know, but we're going to be late for the movie. And you just want to go, you know, I can't believe how insensitive you are. And now and then you get their attention, but not very often. And that's kind of the way it is, you know, and we learn to live. And now and then they get sensitive, but you know, lots of kids aren't, and that's part of the adolescent thing. But this person doesn't ever leave that. They may learn to socially shift it and act like they've left it, but really everything centers around them. And they really don't understand how their behavior impacts somebody else. They, I mean, I'm not even saying in that sense they're even mean about it. They just don't get it. I don't know that. Craig, were you going to throw something in? Your hand
was
moving.
Just that they, my sense would be, they wouldn't have any clear moral judgment. They would be able to rationalize their way out of
anything. Out of anything.
Yeah. So they would be amoral.
Mm-hmm. Sure. They may or may not be a murderer, but the reason they wouldn't be a murderer is because it hadn't been important enough yet to murder somebody. Do you follow?
Yeah. What if you work with someone that you think is in a position, like, I feel that my boss is this particular
one.
I mean, really.
She's
in charge of this, she's in charge of a store, and she's got a very big responsibility, and it seems like she really ties in well with the characteristics of a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
And for someone who works for somebody like this, what are some ways of, I mean, you just get out altogether, because there is really no hope unless you hope and pray that this person gets, you know, canned or removed or, you know, whatever. But how do you if you're working under these circumstances?
Well, I really hear you. I don't know. All I can think of is this whole kind of thing, that is there a grievance system? Is there a way, is there a system set up, which I think in all institutions and organizations, is there a system set up to go over that person's head and say, this is the behavior that I see, and I've tracked it for the last year and a half, and this is consistently what happens, and is there a person above that person that cares? Because that sociopathic person may be making a lot of money for the company, and the company may say, I don't care whether you like it or not.
Right.
This is a functional person in this job, and if you like it, or, you know, that's tough for you. Because here we may not be talking fairness, we may be talking money. You know, the answer to me is always, first, pay attention to data. Second, to go to committee. Don't trust your own things. Because, you know, I can be really upset with somebody, and really, what it really is my own stuff that I bring with me, and when I really get open and look at it with somebody else might not see it quite the same way I do. Then the third thing, I think, is to go to the committee, to whoever you can go to. And it may be that before you do that, when you consult, they may say, you're crazy. They're not going to listen to you because this person functions well for this company. And I don't know. It's not a very good answer. Yes, sir.
I'm just wondering if there's any increase in the incidence rate over years, you know. I mean, has something in society really contributed to psychopathic personalities? Is it in the parenting? I've read certain books and articles,
sure,
about attachment and maybe our pace of life or our God or what. But you talk about the prevention stuff. Is there something? Even before, I teach school, I see kids without conscience.
Mm-hmm.
They just strike out, and remorse is one of the last things that comes to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder, is there a commonality that, you know, you can have all different social classes and
before I try to answer that, which I'm going to do very ineffectively, so let me do something that I can do just a little better. I wanted to erase this. Let me show you one of the patterns that I'm going to talk more about Tuesday. But one of the patterns, and I'll come back and attempt to answer your question. One of the patterns that we see where the remorse does fit in, with particularly person three here, is the addict clearly does this. There's a preoccupation phase. There's a ritual. And I can tell you this. People I work with, after we work with them for 3-4 months, we get this down so pat, it's just as clear as can be. There's an act phase and there's a remorse phase. And this is just as clearly spelled out as can be. And I know this is the opposite of what you're saying, but I'm going to come back to where you are. With the addicted person, not this person, it gets real clear that there is a preoccupation or a thinking about whatever the act is that you get addicted to, the sexual act. And you go for a while, and maybe the while is a week or a month or a year, but you go for a while without it, and then due to stresses or whatever you want to say, it starts building up and it begins to preoccupy. That preoccupation moves into a ritual, and sometimes it takes a little while to figure out the ritual, and in treatment, the ritual is crucial. You don't figure out the ritual, you don't break the pattern. The ritual is crucial. Let me say this, an aside on that, I'm not forgetting your point. An aside on that is the classic ritual that we can see is the person who's a voyeur, who peeps in people's windows. See, voyeurs always get caught. Other folks don't always get caught. But voyeurs go through a ritualistic pattern. Now, it may take them a couple of years because on Monday, on the first Monday of the month, they may walk this route, and they may not walk that route again for 2 weeks. But eventually, after a couple of years, somebody said, I've seen this guy around here before. What's he doing here? And eventually somebody calls the cops, and eventually you catch the voyeur. What the voyeur will tell you is, number one, he doesn't know why he does it, and he wishes he didn't, and the tears are very, they're not these kind of tears. He doesn't want to do that stuff. And he hates it when he gets anxious, and he goes home, and he has a fight with his wife, and goes out for a walk, and winds up going on a route. And you walk for 2 hours because you know that sometimes you get a 20-minute peek, I mean a 20-second peek at this particular window, at this particular gal that happens to undress about 10:30, but you may only catch that once every 4 months. You know, but you go and you go and you go and you keep doing that, or the guy that climbs the tree up to a point where the tree is real shaky and hangs on up there for half an hour, 45 minutes, because he knows that she undresses at about this time. And invariably, if you think about it, the ritual is what turns you on. It's not the peak. It's the ritual. And you don't know that it's the ritual. And where I learned that was, and I luckily quit smoking before I learned it, but I kept trying to figure out, when I was trying to quit smoking, and I see myself as a smoker who doesn't, I haven't had a cigarette in years, but I have that process. I don't like taste of cigarettes. 3 drags into a cigarette, I didn't like it. But I had a ritual, a way of picking up my lighter, tapping the thing out, touching my lips, all kind. I did that ritual. I didn't realize I got off on the ritual. And so I had to break the ritual and do some other things like lifesavers and toothpicks and rubbing my lips and growing a mustache and doing all kinds of things to help break that ritual. But at any rate, after that comes the act, the sexual act that you do. And then with the addict, who's the larger part, because this is a very, very small, of our society, we're talking 0.03 or something, thank goodness. You know, this isn't a whole bunch of folks. This is a whole bunch of folks. The remorse is intense. It's painful. There's tears. There's prayer. You try everything. You do everything. And the remorse slackens it for a while. It stops you from doing it for a while. Now, depending on the intensity, depending on how you're using it, depending on what pain you're in your life, how you're numbing out with it, how much you need it, all that kind of stuff, it may stop you for a week or a month or a year. Or, do you see what I'm saying? Then the preoccupation begins and the thing goes. Now, we'll go to those kids. If they truly don't have any capacity for remorse, this cycle doesn't get going. And then, that's kind of scary because are we budding sociopaths, or are we just having kids who've modeled some really insensitive stuff and they're going through the adolescent thing quite early and getting very self-centered? Part of the question that you were asking that we keep talking about over coffee and dinner and everything, and I don't have any kind of an answer to this. People ask it a lot. Do we have a whole lot more of this now, or do we see it a lot better? And your guess is as good as mine. I don't know. I would be interested in your opinions. I know there's a whole bunch of it out there. And I know, and next week we'll talk more about, I know there's a whole lot we can do for these folks. There's a bunch of hope here. There wasn't a bunch of hope 5-6 years ago. And I will tell you, because I worked a lot with it, there's a bunch of hope here. There's some stuff that we're doing that really, really gives people a chance for hope and restoration. But whether there's more of this now than there was 50 years ago, I don't know. I know we know about it more now. And I know we had the behavior, all three of these, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 500 years ago. But I don't know if we have more of it now. I know we have societies where we don't have much of that. And you can get into all kinds of statistics where it's just crazy. And I'm going to say one that just counters each other, I think. Maybe it doesn't even counter each other. In Sweden, I know, we have very little of this kind of stuff, but we get the highest suicide rate in the world. Now, I don't know. No. So there's more sex, but the people are killing themselves more. And are they tied? I don't know. I don't know about that. That mystifies me. Does anybody have an opinion, or do you have a comment on the question? That one's above me.
Is there any commonality behind... I mean, are they working on trying to say maybe there's some link behind these personalities?
People are working on that all the time, constantly, and I don't think that we know, you know, in this whole thing, all this sexual deviance stuff, boy, if you go back more than 5 or 6 years as a therapist, you're an old timer. You really are. We just don't know much about this stuff. We're learning some stuff that's really working, but we've just got tons of way to go. I know that we're infinitely better about reporting now than we ever used to be. But whether there's more to report, my gut reaction is that there probably isn't any more to report. But then, I don't know. Maybe there is. I just don't know how to make that judgment. See, then you get into the whole pornographic thing, which most folks like to get into and argue about. And maybe because there's more pornography, there's more of this kind of thing. On the other hand, maybe because there's more pornography, there's less of this kind of thing. I don't know. I don't know. I just cannot speak to that. I know this. I will make a definitive statement about this. For individuals who are caught in this process, pornography is death. You cannot do it. I don't care what the President's Council says, how the Commission says, the Mies Commission, any of that. It's no different than the alcoholic who says to you, don't press me to have a drink because I can't drink. Okay? This person cannot do pornography. Can't do it. No way. It gets them going in a cycle that... But I'm not going to say for a minute that pornography does or doesn't do that to other people. But it does to this person. There's a whole lot of sexual stuff. Masturbation is, when it's part of a cycle here, it's not a good thing for the person caught in this kind of pattern. Well, you guys are hinting we all have to quit. So, goes fast when it's hot, doesn't it? Thank you for coming.